It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk to a language creator about invented languages, like Elvish from Lord of the Rings and Klingon from Star Trek.
But first, we're talking to a legal expert about the possibility of the Justice Department seeking criminal civil rights charges against George Zimmerman. This weekend, Zimmerman was acquitted of murder and manslaughter charges in the death of the unarmed black teen Trayvon Martin.
Now, activists are calling on the Justice Department to file a suit alleging that Zimmerman racially profiled Trayvon Martin, which led to the teen's death. This weekend, so many people were going to the NAACP's website to sign a petition for that to happen that it crashed the site.
And here to break down the potential for that federal case is Karen Conti, a partner in the Bierman Law Firm and an adjunct professor at University of Illinois College of Law and DePaul Law. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How likely is it that the Justice Department will file a suit against George Zimmerman?
I don't think they will, Veronica, and here's why I think it. First of all, this case was tried already. From a political standpoint, it was tried. It was aggressively tried by the prosecution. The jury spoke, and I think there should be an end to this. However, there's some legal issues, too, and that is the prosecution would have to show some racial animus, and although this case is much has been made about it being a racial case, the prosecution would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the reason Zimmerman did any of these things, including shoot him, was for racial reasons. And that's a very hard thing to prove, to get in someone's head to prove it, and I just don't think they have, pardon the pun, the guns to do it.
But the federal government has stepped in and done this before. It prosecuted those acquitted in the Rodney King trial, for instance, another racially charged case. Why do you think that one's different?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, I think there's a problem with this as far as double jeopardy goes. I think people know this from their Constitution classes, that you can't try the person twice for the same crime. But these are different crimes. This is a crime of civil rights violation versus murder or manslaughter. You know, Rodney King, I think that was also a political case. I think that the federal government believed that the state did not prosecute correctly and the jury did not rule correctly, and they wanted to take a second bite at the apple. I think that this one might just be different because I think there's less evidence. We don't have a videotape of the beating. That beating was so severe and it was all captured on video. And here we don't have any picture of what really happened. All we have is he said, she said, some tapes that we can't really decipher who was, and maybe one eyewitness who saw Trayvon Martin on top, which is, again, not good for the prosecution.
Can you explain what exactly these federal civil rights charges would be if they were to go forward?
They basically say that a person's civil rights were violated because someone using racial animus, evil intent, bad intent, acted wrongfully while the person was on a public place. It's basically that, you know, you did something that was racially motivated. And again, that's completely different than the charges that were tried against Zimmerman, which were manslaughter. That was the wrongful killing of a human being. This is a totally different crime. But again, very hard to prove because of the motivation. Getting into someone's head and proving intent is very difficult.
Now, Karen, we heard at the beginning as we went into this segment about how the NAACP's website was crashed with people trying to sign the petition for these federal charges to be pressed. And yet, you're saying it's probably pretty unlikely. So how much weight does the public have in this seesaw about whether or not it's going to happen?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case really bears that out. I mean, what happened in the case, as you recall, the prosecution declined to bring charges. The police did their investigation and didn't find enough evidence. Prosecution said no, so the governor appointed a special prosecutor, a very able prosecutor, who brought the charges. Now, is that motivated by politics? Absolutely, because I think the public was crying out for a prosecution. I do think the federal government takes a different stand. They don't want to lose this case. They've seen the trial. They saw what happened. They saw that there were big holes and gaps in the evidence. And I don't think they're going to try a case that they're going to lose. I just don't think that they're going to do it. And, you know, all prosecutions are somewhat political in some way, shape, or form, because crimes are committed every day that don't get prosecuted. And I think the government has to pick and choose what it wants to prosecute.
Now, you said that you think they won't go forward, and you agree with that, it sounds like. You said this needs to end. Why are you saying that? Are you saying that because you think that the country needs to move forward and get on with healing, or is there another reason there?
I suppose that's part of it, Veronica, but here's what I think. And I may not be popular for saying this. I'm on the liberal end of the spectrum, if that makes any difference at all in this analysis. But I think that this is a case of facts, and this is a case of specific facts, and whether or not we can prove things by beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't know that this is a case for flag waving when it comes to race. I think we have race problems in our country. I think that there were some race profiling issues in this case. But when it comes right down to the facts, the jury ruled on it. And you can't make someone a scapegoat for racial discrimination. And this case, I don't think, is about race as much as it is. We don't know what happened those moments before the gun went off. And the jury, it sounded like, did a very good job of deliberating and listening and being careful. And both parties were represented very adequately. This was tried. Why are we continuing to do it? What are we going to accomplish with it, I guess?
Now, let's talk about the jury for a moment. Their names have not been released. They may be released, and things may come out about them that people will call into question. I would expect that would happen if they were to be released. Will that change anything?
No, it won't change anything. I would like to hear from the jury. I think everyone would like to hear, why did you rule the way you ruled? Why did you ask the question about clarifying the manslaughter jury instruction? What did you think was the most telling evidence for and against a conviction? I would love to hear them, because they were in the courtroom. You know, as much as I can call myself a legal pundit who followed this case, I wasn't there every day. I didn't watch every single piece of testimony and watch the demeanor of everyone. So I would like to hear from them. But, you know, what they say matters not at all. It's not like you can reverse an acquittal based upon what a juror says.
Now, if these federal charges don't get pressed, does the Trayvon Martin family, do they have any other recourse?
Sure, they can file a civil lawsuit. And in that, they would just have to allege that Zimmerman was negligent and therefore caused the death of their son. So basically, those standards are lower, and a lot of people say, well, gosh, he was acquitted. Why could they sue him civilly? Well, this was like the O.J. case, as you recall. O.J. was acquitted, but the Goldman family and Brown family brought a lawsuit against O.J. saying, you wrongfully killed my family members, and got a huge judgment against him that they, I think, are continuing to try to collect. So in this country, we have beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case, but negligence is just a lower standard. He was just negligent, and if that's proven to a jury, they can actually get a judgment against Zimmerman. Now, what good is that going to be? How much money does he have to collect? You know, I don't know.
Do you think they have a decent shot at that one?
I think they do. I actually think they do, because was it negligent for him to take out a gun and shoot somebody and kill? Maybe it was. Maybe it was the heat of the moment. We also have to consider that Zimmerman could actually bring a countersuit against Trayvon Martin's family to say that he had injuries relating to this incident that were not his fault. So that wouldn't be out of the question.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Veronica. Take care.
That was Karen Conti, a law professor and partner at Bierman Law Firm.
We want to know what you think now of the acquittal of George Zimmerman. Do you think the jury made the right decision? How did you react when that verdict was announced? You can call in for our sound off at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. And now we want to hear from you.
We're talking about the verdict in the George Zimmerman trial. Did you agree with the not guilty verdict? Do you want the Justice Department to open its own case against Zimmerman? How do you feel about the acquittal? And what do you think it says something wider about American society?
You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. And you can also go ahead and post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go straight to the phones now. We have Steve in Hillsborough on the line. Steve, hi. You're on the air.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. What do you think about this?
I agree with the jury 110%. I feel that he did everything he could to preserve his own life, and that comes right down to it. Is the most important thing is to preserve your own life.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for calling in and starting out this sound off. Who do we have next, Veronica?
Well, we've got, I want to read an email next. This is from Ray in Manitowoc, who says, so now it looks like we should have to have several trials for cases that don't turn out the way some people think they should. Who in their right mind would want to be a juror? Both the prosecution and the defense presented cases, and I would have found the man not guilty also with the flimsy evidence.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steve, and the comment, Ray. We'll go back now to the phones with Bill in Waukesha. Hi there, Bill.
Hey, hi. Thanks for your show. I agree with the jury, except for one problem in the coverage of it all. I think we have not heard enough about the bigger picture of what happened on that occasion. I can relate to Zimmerman feeling like his life was threatened at that moment, but we haven't asked about why he kept following this Trayvon Martin through the complex. We haven't considered what it means for police to aggravate a situation that then becomes as bad as this one and requires a gunshot going off someplace along the way. And so I'm really interested in how we might, as a society, ask some questions about the bigger picture of that evening and not just about the moment when Zimmerman was feeling as though his life was threatened. Maybe he should have thought about that 5 minutes before, or 15 minutes, or 30 minutes before. And why, after the police were called, what gives the neighborhood watch guy the authority to intervene in a situation when the police have already been called? What's his role in all that? Well, those are some questions that I think we as a society need to be addressing and not simply focus on the moment that Zimmerman fired in self-defense.
Got it. Thank you so much. Interesting questions, Bill.
All right, and let's take our next call. This is Lynn joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I totally believe that justice was not served. But Mr. Zimmerman has now placed himself in hell because he will go through the rest of his life. I don't believe in retribution, but he will never be comfortable. He has to look over his shoulder waiting for someone to get even. And it's a tragedy all the way around. Nobody won. Everybody lost.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Lynn.
We'll go now to Susan with us in West Dallas. Hi there, Susan.
Hi. I wanted to say that I disagreed with the jury verdict. And my big question is, why would some 17-year-old person, child, if he was going to be up to no good, take out his cell phone and be having a conversation? I mean, I can hardly imagine him crunching that phone under his shoulder so he could have both of his hands free. So it doesn't make sense to me. And I don't know why that point was never raised.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for calling in, Susan. We are having a sound off. Your chance to share your thoughts on the verdict in that trial this week, George Zimmerman and the shooting of Trayvon Martin, the not guilty verdict. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@WPR.org. And, of course, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're hearing lots of your thoughts and lingering questions you still have despite this verdict. And we go next to Maureen, who's with us in Waukesha. Hi there.
Hi. I think the jury got it right. I watched the case almost every single day. And based on the facts that were presented, the state did not prove that murder was committed or manslaughter. And in hearing people's reaction, the public reaction to this, I realized that most people are still reacting based on the media hype before the trial even started, because the comments a lot of people are making are not based on anything that was actually presented in the case. It was all that noise that happened before the trial started, and I think that's sad. The whole situation is sad.
Hey, Maureen, before you go, I just thanks for sharing your thoughts, but you said you watched every day. What was it about this trial that captivated you and kept your eyes glued to the coverage?
Well, because I guess I've always sort of been a fan of the underdog. And at first, you know, just based on what was in the media, I thought, you know, okay, let's a guy who was unarmed, you know, boy, how is that not wrong? And then, so I listened to the facts of the case, and George Zimmerman was attacked. And the information about Trayvon Martin's character was continually suppressed. But he was a violent, not a child, a violent young man, teen, who was only in Florida because he had been suspended on drug charges for 10 days from school. But most people didn't know that. I mean, he was kind of a scary kid. So, like I said, I think those are facts that most people, you know, don't want to face or don't want to look at. And like I said, I think the whole thing is tragic. It's a sad tragedy that it happened. But I
Maureen, thanks a lot for the call.
And we move on next to Chris, who's with us from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I totally disagree with the verdict. Basically, Zimmerman created the situation. You know, it's one thing if he witnesses something and then steps in, but without him there, without the gun there, there is no situation. Essentially, he's coming after a person walking down the sidewalk. So, you know, the people want their guns, but they don't want to take responsibility for having them. So I totally disagree with the verdict.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
You can join in again at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We have on the line now Tammy in Onalaska. No, I'm sorry, Tammy's gone. Ken in Deerfield, Illinois, then, is next. Hi there, Ken.
Hi. I wanted to say two things. First of all, two callers ago was talking about Martin's character and that he was suspended on drug charges, all that stuff. And I think that's completely irrelevant because there is no way that Zimmerman could have known any of those facts at the time of this altercation. You know, Martin could have been a choir boy and this whole thing would have gone down the exact same way. So there was nothing in his behavior that, you know, made him suspicious or threatening. So that's completely moot. And I think that was why it was excluded from the trial. Secondly, I do agree with the verdict, but only in the strictest legal sense. I mean, I think that Martin was indeed murdered in, you know, the spirit of the law, if not the letter of it. And this is basically the stand your ground laws are kind of free reign to, you know, get into a fight with somebody, kill them. There's no witnesses, and a jury essentially has to prove that you weren't in danger, which is nearly impossible. So I do agree with it, but I think it's a total miscarriage of justice.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call. And we move next to Mike, who's with us in Dodgeville. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Pretty good. Thanks.
You know, I watched a lot of the trial, and I'm in agreement with what the jury came back with for the verdict. But I'd really like to say that people keep saying that George Zimmerman is a free man again. George Zimmerman was always a free man. He never was guilty of any crime. And to depict him as assaulting and killing a young unarmed man while his head was being pummeled onto the concrete, that was the weapon that was used. Trayvon Martin, like your caller before said, he was a minor league criminal. He was just practicing to become a major league criminal, and the first time he stepped into the majors, he got knocked out of the box. It's unfortunate that it happened. Nobody wants to see a young man's life end it tragically like that. But I think that Trayvon created this whole problem, and the jury saw the facts and acquitted George Zimmerman, who was always free.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. By the way, this time tomorrow, we'll talk some more about this issue as related to the racial divide in the United States. That's 4:15 to 4:45 tomorrow.
And we'll go next to Wayne. Wayne with us from West Dallas. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Yes, I believe that Zimmerman is guilty of murder. For one thing, he was acting, I believe, as a vigilante. He doesn't have experience or training as a law enforcement officer. He didn't. I don't believe he showed any identification that he was a law enforcement officer. Therefore, there's more to this story than we know about. You just can't follow somebody and then get into a fight with them and shoot them and say that he was protecting the neighborhood or whatever.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Wayne. We'll go now to Tomas in Arlington. Hi, Tomas.
How you doing?
Pretty good. You?
I believe George Zimmerman definitely was guilty, you know. And what I understand with today's society, where being a black man, the way I look at it is if I hear that, well, you got so much disrespect to a black president of the United States, are you really thinking about really going to respect a black man to begin with? I mean, being from the South down in Mississippi for many years when I was growing up, there used to be a saying that a cow is worth more than a black man's life. I mean, and that's what it is. In today's day, if a black man kills a white person, he goes to jail automatically. It's no and if or but. He don't get a 5-year trial. But if a white guy killed a black person, the first thing that happens is he gets slapped on the hand and gets released. I mean, it's ridiculous how the system works in this country. It's supposed to be America, United States of America. And here you got a country that's still using the Jim Crow, racism, and jobs and everything you go here. If you look at these jobs across the country, you see what's going on. You look at the bachelor. Come on, you think about it. It's a lot of eligible black people who can be bachelors. They're not on TV.
Tomas, I've got to cut in because we're going to wrap up the segment now.
But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today and all of you who joined our sound off today. Lots of strong feelings still lingering here in the state of Wisconsin. Thanks for that. And you can keep the conversation going on our Facebook page, and we'll have more coverage of the Zimmerman case later this week. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The news is coming up next, and then we'll talk to a reporter about an upcoming series on Wisconsin's cold cases and how they could be solved with DNA evidence. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This week in Gannett Newspapers, in a partnership with the Center for Investigative Journalism, launched their new Cold Cases series.
The stories will delve into Wisconsin's cold cases in the last 50 years. They'll also look at how new technologies and circumstances have been game changers to some of these tragic cases.
Now, here to preview the series and to talk about his first piece in the series is contributing writer Andy Thompson. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, how do we define cold case? How long does a case have to be unsolved for it to go cold?
Well, you know, that's kind of, police departments kind of bristle at cold case, that term sometimes, because it implies they aren't working on a case. We simply say, you know, that, for example, over the last 10 years, we've got roughly 300 cases in Wisconsin that have gone unsolved. And we've been tracking cases through a variety of methods. It looks to be about 400 in the last 50 or 60 years. We're kind of looking at a year by year thing, and there's really no good definition of cold case. It's kind of a term that's kind of out there, but I think. We're kind of looking at a year-by-year thing. Like I say, in the last 10 years, we've had quite a few of them, and most of them in Milwaukee. But to get a certain definition is kind of difficult.
And we're going to spend some time talking about new technology, especially DNA technology, and how it's changed things. But let's go back before that. Like, in the days before DNA testing, how often was a cold case successfully solved?
Not very often. You know, it had to be typically then that someone's conscience getting the better of them and them coming forward, or kind of police working a case and getting someone who was involved in the crime tangentially, or someone who overheard something or was aware of something. So it didn't happen terribly often. It was, I'd say it's more somebody clearing their conscience back then. So it was DNA just kind of threw this into a whole new stratosphere.
And now, what kind of stories are you going to be telling in this series?
Well, we had one that we had a story that ran today. It was about a 1963 case in Winnebago County near the gas station. There was a man shot at a gas station between Oshkosh and Nina. He lived near the station, and a car pulled up one night, and he walked over there to service the car or whatever. He was taken to a back room and stabbed him 53 times, I believe. His case never got solved, and while back then they did a lot of lie detector tests and interviews, and they just never had anything strong enough where they could charge anybody. Well, now, I mean, in doing interviews where we went back through all these cases here, when I talked to the sheriff in that county, I was a little surprised to hear that they actually do have some dried blood evidence that they still have in a storage locker from this case that is worthy of DNA testing, and they're sending that in as we speak here. He's pretty confident that they do have suspects back then that they still have reports on and interviews of people, and the DNA they're hoping can use to match a suspect with the crime scene.
So this
is one example. There's several other ones. I mean, that there's another case around here where a girl was, a 17-year-old girl was found murdered in 1978. The same kind of thing where you had some suspects develop it, but never enough evidence. And now they have some biological evidence from the crime scene that they're also sending down to the state crime labs, DNA testing unit. So there's just a couple. I mean, there's other examples like that, but those are two fairly prominent ones.
So that's a 35-year-old case and a 50-year-old case, and thanks to the new technology, the police are thinking, hey, we've got a shot still at solving this if we test this DNA.
Yeah, it really is kind of shocking that that they can, and it doesn't work in every case, obviously, mm-hmm. but the mere fact that they, you know, that there's this kind of new optimism out there among, you know, among police departments and sheriff's departments that geez, we don't need a whole lot of a big, they don't need like a, you know, a big vial of blood or something. It's just a matter of, you know, the fairly minute amount of evidence that could really, you know, wrap up a case. And obviously we have the human factor here with some of these families and relatives or have suffered for years trying to find out what happened to their children or spouse, and this is really exciting for them as well.
But it seems like the tricky bit is, even if you have this evidence, you can test the DNA, you have to have something to match it up against. So is the hope
right.
that there's DNA evidence from somebody who maybe was prosecuted for something else that they can match it to?
Yeah, exactly right. They certainly the DNA data bank has grown by leaps and bounds over the years. I think there's 160,000 names in it right now, just of Wisconsin individuals. And yeah, that's the certainly. If there's nothing to match the crime scene evidence to it, it's there. And at some point, it's either people who are already in the system, already in prison, or obviously people who are added to the system when they're arrested. If they're arrested tomorrow or something, and their sample winds up in the system or convicted, I mean, that's certainly another possibility. But yeah, you make a good point with that.
And you talked to some people, you mentioned relatives of victims still wondering what happened. Mm-hmm. Is this, I mean, the fact that these are still unsolved, how much does that weigh on them when you talk to them?
Well, you know, it weighs real heavily. I mean, you have, we often write stories about people who have gone through this, and I don't know that you can ever, I mean, if you just envision if you have a child and a child disappears and is found dead and you never find out what happens to them, or it's hard to describe. I mean, I can't relate to that, you know, but a lot of these people have suffered for decades and decades, and to them this is kind of gives them a little bit of hope. And certainly it's something that, you know, you kind of root for them that they can find some answers that they've been waiting for all this time.
And then the sense you got talking to police, I mean, this has got to kind of stick in their craw, right? I mean, I was there. If, you know, the police officer was there 50 years ago, mm-hmm. they know this crime was committed. They never solved it. How eager are they that this evidence might finally close these cases?
Well, yeah, they're very eager. I mean, it's. I think that a lot of them have said to me, gee, I wish we had this kind of testing back, or I wish they had this testing back in 1970 or 1960. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's any better feeling for an officer to crack a cold case. And I'm sure I've talked to a number of retired detectives who retired before one of their big cases got solved. And I think that always weighs on them as well, that they weren't able to finish off a case and so certainly there's that angle as well.
Are you know, you've been writing about this, you've got this series coming out now. Are you optimistic that some of these cases you're looking at might be solved or get closer to a solution?
Yeah, you know, I think it's certainly possible. You know, you just never know what's going to happen. I think a lot of times when we're putting together a database of you know, hundreds and hundreds of unsolved murders that with pictures, and I've talked to officers who, when these get publicized, that they routinely get a lot of calls that come in, and I think that's certainly something that if it did happen as a result of that, would be, you know, really a great thing.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Andy Thompson. We've got a link to the start of that series. He writes for the Appleton Post-Crescent, and he's working on this ongoing series on cold cases and how they're trying to solve them.
And coming up next, we'll talk about Elvish, Klingon, and other invented languages in our regular words segment. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
Coming up at 5, we'll look at the way parents live out their ambitions through their children on the sports field and on the stage.
Now we're going to look at language, but not the ones we hear spoken in our reality. Let's give a quick listen.
Well, if you understood any of those, you're probably a nerd. That was the Dothraki language from HBO's Game of Thrones, Elvish from The Lord of the Rings, and a bit of Klingon from Star Trek.
I understood all of those, Veronica. Thanks. So we're wondering what goes into creating a fictional language. We turn to a group called the Language Creation Society. They study invented languages. They share info among language creators. And sometimes they consult for movies and TV shows. Well, it turns out one of their members was just down the road from us. William Ennis of Madison joins us. He's a language creator and a board member of the Language Creation Society. William, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first, how did you get into creating languages?
Probably an early impressionistic exposure to Latin left me with a love of large grammar charts. Not very sophisticated, really, in terms of language invention, but you have to start somewhere. So, yeah, Latin got me going. And most people... early love of language is what triggers this unusual hobby of inventing your own language.
So what exactly goes into creating a realistic language that's made up, like Dothraki or Klingon?
To make a realistic language takes a lot of work. Most people these days try to imagine first an earlier stage of the language and then run it through a historical mill to rub off some changes, make some things that add irregularities that, you know, tortured us in school when we were learning languages and we hate, but that makes a language look real. So you'll start with sounds and some grammar, maybe based on some ideas you have already. Maybe you're going to mix natural languages, and then you just run it through and see what comes out the other end.
And that seems like the important thing. It's not like a code. It's not like table is Gardach and air is Bluchach,
right,
and there's my language.
Right. Certainly many people start that way, and when I, you know, was impressed by Latin and started doing my own thing, it was really, you know, Latin and English and some extra bits. But yeah, to be really realistic, you need to think about history and culture and all of that stuff.
So as you watch all these invented languages on the big screen, we heard Dothraki from Game of Thrones, we've heard Klingon over the years and Elvish. Are you impressed with all of them, or are some of them a little bit better and more sophisticated that you go, aha, there's someone who knew what they were doing when they created that language?
For the big ones that we've seen in the big science fiction and fantasy movies, they've been pretty good. Some early movies, maybe we're not so good. Maybe a little. Star Wars had some problems that we don't like to talk about too much.
They are bantha fodder.
They're bantha fodder for, you know, taking field recordings of actual human languages and speeding them up in process.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know they did that.
Or, you know, gibberish produced by various people. But most of the big ones these days are good, and I credit the Lord of the Rings movies with convincing movie producers and television producers that audiences will know when they're being fooled.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. Now, you've got the movies. So J.R.R. Tolkien obviously had a lot of fun making up languages. How did he do when he was making up things like Elvish and the other languages in his books?
Oh, he's the patron saint of language invention. He is the originator of this historical approach. He was so into this, though, that it's impossible really to produce a single line of Elvish if you want to now, because he never, ever stopped tinkering.
He couldn't leave it alone.
He could not ever leave it alone, and he was always adding new changes, more of this historical process, largely because that's what he was a professor of.
Well, didn't he like to go back and look at the ancient roots of words and trace it as far back as he could, and then, you know, you had a voila, a word of Elvish.
Sure. That was his job. That was his day job as well as an academic, was to look at the history of words and then look at the history of the culture, the sound changes, all of that is what he was reproducing in an artistic way in his books.
Now, if I were to decide, and I won't, but if I were to decide to start a language, it seems like a really tall task. What would my first step be, do you reckon?
Probably to start with the sound system. Figure out what sounds you want, what sounds you don't want. How they're going to interact determines a lot of the character of a language. And from there on, you have to decide, are you going to actually have adjectives? You know, you need to make some basic decisions about the grammar.
So wait, we can have a language without adjectives?
Oh, easily. Many human languages don't have them.
Wow. Okay. That's really... See, I don't even know how to express how that language would be without an adjective to describe it.
Some languages, they act like verbs. So instead of saying, you know, the angry dog, you have to say the dog who is angry all the time.
Hmm. The angering dog. Interesting.
Or that, yeah.
Huh. Okay, so we've got our sounds, we've got our basic decisions, adjectives, no adjectives. Then what next?
Start making charts. Find out the grammar. Are you doing things with verbs? Are you conjugating the verbs? Do you talk about tense the same way the European languages do, or do you just ditch tense altogether, which lots of languages do? And then is the big grind, which not everyone loves, and that is creating the words. And most languages that hobbyists create never get beyond a few hundred words, and a few really magnificent ones have thousands or even tens of thousands.
Now, you create languages. You're a board member of the Language Creation Society. What kinds of things is the Language Creation Society involved in? What are they working on now that's cool?
We're the main contact point for people who want a language for their property, TV, movie, video game, whatever, and don't know who to contact. So they can contact us. We have a jobs board. There are various kinds of...
You can get a paid job doing this.
Oh, absolutely.
Hmm.
Wow.
Cool.
That's the main thing. There's also a conference which appears about every other year where language inventors get together and present their work or interesting things related to language invention. And those are the main ones. And there's a journal monthly that comes out where people write articles about a range of topics, both related to how natural languages might interact with invented languages and just invented languages in general.
And now stepping outside the movies and TV, there have been efforts to create from whole cloth languages that we use in the real world. I'm thinking mainly of Esperanto. There's an effort to make that an original or a common language, an international language, I guess.
Right.
How did that happen and how did it fall short?
There was a big intellectual movement when Esperanto appeared. It was by no means the first. It is certainly not the last. People never stop inventing new languages to satisfy this role of international communication with a neutral tool, rather than forcing everyone to learn someone else's language. And that was really part of the intellectual movement of the time. There were philosophical languages. Leibniz envisioned a language where instead of having to argue about things, people would just say what they needed to say, and then you would just calculate, and you would find the truth. That was a philosophical aspiration. And people still make languages like that, or try to. Probably World War I killed the sort of not utopian, but idealistic concept of a common language uniting people. Mm. And, you know, the World War II ended it completely. Esperanto is certainly the most successful of all of these languages. Possibly a million people use it from time to time. But because it never took over, people always are trying to make new ones.
Is there a problem in... It is one of the challenges in creating a language that, as you mentioned, real-life languages evolved over time, and all the poor language creator could do is simulate that evolution over time?
That is a really interesting question that people continue to argue about and will be arguing about long after we're gone. Esperanto, after a fashion, has developed a culture of its own. It's been around long enough. There are approximately 1,000 people who've spoken it natively. Most famously, George Soros grew up speaking Esperanto. But there are various, usually political things that keep people from adopting a common auxiliary language. Because if you're just trying to have a tool for people to exchange in common, they don't need the full culture in that language. They just need to get their information across.
Now, you've been exposed to lots of invented languages. You know how people say French is the language of love, and German language, some people say, is very practical. It's a language that makes logistical sense. When you survey the languages that have been created, we've talked about a few of them in the segment so far, but is there one that pleases you especially? We talked about, you know, which ones you thought were solid, but is there one that you find the most aesthetically pleasing?
The most aesthetically pleasing. That's a really hard question for me to answer because I judge languages differently. I really like the sound of the Elvish languages that Tolkien invented. I like the grammatical insanity of Klingon. It's so unlike what most people are exposed to.
No, wait, I have to stop you there. Why is it grammatically insane?
That's a little hard to explain in a short period of time. The grammar is very unusual. Mm. In English, our word order is usually, you know, subject, verb, object. The man saw the woman. In Klingon, the word order is reversed completely.
That the woman was seen by the man?
No.
No?
Uh-oh.
That's too logical.
That's just
cursed
a passive.
By logical human
yeah,
brain.
That's just a passive trying to fake it out. And there are other things, like words become enormously huge because you keep suffixing new elements to indicate grammar and stuff.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
I want to learn some Klingon.
Yeah. What really fascinates me is there's this subculture of you and your colleagues, and you call it conlanging, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of an awkward word for language creators.
Yeah, I agree completely that you'd think people devoted and lovers of language could come up with a slightly more attractive name for what we do than conlanging.
But you're out there inventing languages and sharing them back and forth. So do you critique or help contribute or help develop one another's ideas? Do you bounce these things back and forth?
Absolutely. On web forums, on mailing lists, people are constantly presenting either their languages entirely on web pages or parts, or what am I going to do with this? I thought I was going to do this with a verb and it all fell apart. What do I do? Help. So yeah, people really talk about these things and think deeply about the issue.
So wait, that happens. You can paint yourself into a corner, kind of. You've got these well-established rules and the ways things work, and you hit a point where the pieces don't match up, and you have to back up.
Absolutely, I've compared language invention to a really complex Sudoku puzzle that is not just a page; it's several volumes. The parts all have to interact correctly.
Now, is this your full-time job or do you do this in your free time?
No.
This is a hobby, right?
This is a hobby for most people.
You do this in your
people.
Free time.
Yes. I have applied for jobs and hopefully someday I'll get one, but it's not happened yet.
What is it that, in this show in general, I love talking to people who are enthusiastic about doing something that most people don't do. What is it that it tickles in your brain when you solve that problem in the language you're trying to develop?
That's really hard for me to explain. I've been fascinated by languages since I was very young. Once I first saw my babysitter studying Spanish and I learned that there were words like agua for water, I was harassing everyone who'd taken Spanish just to learn that stuff. People who really love language, this is another way to express that love or play around with ideas that come in language.
Do you speak other languages, you know, real ones besides?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know any language inventor who doesn't also have a love of
what
natural
languages. What else do you speak?
I was a classical Chinese major for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Arabic, German, Latin, Greek, dead languages mostly.
Ah, multi.
I envy you. I'm abysmal with languages. My limited exposure to German and Polish kind of taught me the harsh lesson. Advice for me if I wanted to learn a language, real or invented?
A little bit every day.
A little bit every day.
Cramming is not going to help you.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. William, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was William Ennis with the Language Creation Society.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the ways parents try to live out their ambitions through the children. I'm hoping that I'm not doing this too badly. Maybe Veronica, you are too.
Nope. I'm innocent.
They're playing soccer. I'm trying to stay quiet on the sideline. We'll stick around. There's a lot more to come. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. The news is coming up next right here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.